Hello and welcome to episode 53 of the First Take Film Club podcast. My name is Luke Chandley, and as usual, I'm joined by my fantastic co-hosts Connor Norcott and Liam Jones. Boys, how are you? Connor, I'll come to you. How are you, mate?
I'm good, you know. I'm glad. Am I glad? I think I'm glad you came to me first, because I've had a bit of a rough day today, and I'm just glad to be home, and we're going to talk about a film that's really boss. And that's all I'm going to say. I'm not going to nag anyone out. And I've got a little Lucozade to keep me going.
Oh, no, this is a real package for keeping you going, isn't it? But, all right, well, Liam, are you any better than what Connor just said? Have you got a Lucozade or have you had an all right day?
Oh, I've just had a litre of Lucozade, actually, and the coffee.
Oh, wow.
I've worked an 11-hour shift on 3 hours sleep. So, and like, oof. I only got back an hour ago. So I'm quite tired. I feel all right, though. I've just got to do it again tomorrow. So it's like, by the time I get off this podcast, I'll have my tea and go to bed. So it's kind of like...
That's heavy.
Not the greatest of days, but you know...
It all falls on you then, Luke, by the signs of it.
That's what happens living in a Tory government. You just got to work, eat, sleep, repeat, I guess. That's how it works.
It is, mate. As for myself, I'm fine. Really busy. My feet are cold. And I've just been had a busy day. But I think, to be fair, I think you guys have like got reason to be a little bit tired and emotional. I just haven't really.
He's got
cold feet, yeah, absolutely. Okay, so we'll move on from the cold feet, and I'll tell you about the film that we're actually going to talk about today. It is Alfred Hitchcock's North by Northwest. I had absolutely no idea about this film, really. I didn't really know much about what happened. I knew one or two of the famous scenes, but I'm really, really excited to talk about it. And then I think from what we were talking about off air, I think we're all kind of quite excited to get stuck into it. But what we'll do first is we'll do what we usually do, and that's just give a little opening question. And I thought of this about 2 minutes before we actually started recording, so it's entirely my fault if this is a crap question, listeners, so I'm really sorry. But the opening question is, name a film that you associate with a season, so one of the seasons, what are they? I was going to say January, February, summer. March, April, spring, summer, autumn, winter. So name a film associated with one of those seasons that doesn't necessarily link to the season. I'll give you mine by way of an example. So the older James Bond films remind me of Christmas. And I'm pretty sure none of them involve anything to do with Christmas in either of them. But it's just like that they're always just they must be cheap to buy for ITV, but they're always on ITV.
You can always catch Casino Royale on ITV4 or something on a Boxing Day afternoon. And
it's, the Roger Moore Bonds are always on ITV4. They love a goofy Bond film to
they
ITV4.
Do.
Yeah.
It's very they ITV, do. Very Adrian Childs that, and I'm not into it.
So that was my example. Well, that was my choice and by way of example. Liam, you said you were struggling a little bit. Have you got some?
No, I've actually got I feel like mine is actually quite a nice answer. So when I was a kid, at Easter, instead of Easter eggs, or as well as Easter eggs, my mum and dad would get me a DVD. For some reason, it's coming to my head. I can remember like a lot of them. I don't know if you ever remember a film called The Spiderwick Chronicles.
Yeah.
I had that one year. Probably a couple of Harry Potter films. I think I had Twilight one year, but one that always sticks out to me, reminds me of spring, it's just Easter, sometimes it's Easter. Depends when Easter falls, but in my mind, it always falls in spring for some reason, even though it doesn't. But, you know, the film I think of is Wallace and Gromit and the Curse of the Were-Rabbit.
That is great.
That one has escaped me. I've never saw that one before. But
boys,
please.
In all fairness, I promise you, Connor, it is one of the best animated films like of all time.
Well, what
it is, it just is hands down. Wallace and Gromit. I can't remember what's his name. Nick someone. Nick Aardman. It's not Nick Aardman, but
Nick Park.
Nick Park. That's it. Thank you. Yeah, Nick Park of Aardman, of Wallace and Gromit. Yeah, he's a bit of a genius, isn't he? And yeah, they're doing Chicken Run 2. I know. That's just coming to my head. That's a thing that's happening.
Yeah.
That's my answer. Sorry,
it's all right. So I love Wallace and Gromit, and I'm going to say, is it that one where they've got the joke where there's the fella is like, I don't know if he's set fire to something, and he says the joke is arson around. Do you remember that? Yeah. It's such a classic family friendly joke, and I think it's said by a character voiced by Peter Kay, so it's such a broad Lancashire accent. But that was that's one of my favourite jokes in Wallace and Gromit. Connor, mate, have you got anything that doesn't involve plasticine?
Yeah, I guess I do. I think initially when you asked this about 3 seconds before we went on air and let us know about it, the first film that came to my mind was Do the Right Thing, but then I was like, oh wait, that's actually set in summer and the hottest day of summer.
Okay,
kind of cheating there. But I'm gonna have to just go through all the seasons really. Christmas for me, my big Christmas one is always something like Gladiator. It reminds me of like being in my granddad's house or sitting in front of the fire in my house. And I think I've watched that film about 25 billion times. And it just gets better, really, if I'm honest. That's my big Christmas one. You guys have mentioned the Harry Potters, and James Bond is another one for me. It's kind of just big, dumb franchise movies that I'm just really into.
Isn't it?
I only really go home for like seasonal holidays, whether it's... Christmas, obviously, or then my birthday is normally around springtime, Easter time. So I think those two are the seasons that jump out, and it's always stuff like I said, even some of the Marvel movies. Actually, I watch quite a lot of those. If my mum's listening, which she might be,
Iron Man 3 is a Christmas film, so you know you're spot on there.
True. Okay. Fuck it, it's Iron Man 3. There we go.
All right, sweet. There we are then. Well, that was considering we didn't really think about our answers to that question. I think it went better than some of our other open questions. But,
I'm a little bit disappointed today that nobody's mentioned food. We always talk about food.
We do.
Well, we did mention Lucozade.
I've got some food.
We mentioned
news.
Lucozade.
Oh, go on.
Oh, well, just my tea, if you want to hear what that is.
I'm
having bowel buns. I got them from Marks's. I feel like the bowel buns, so I bought the buns and all the gear to go in it, and I feel like it would have been much cheaper for me to drive to like Wagamama or something, pick it up from Wagamama, drive home, including parking charges, and just eat them at home, because Marks's is... It's quite expensive. So.
I do feel
There's a gaff on Myrtle Street in Liverpool that do very cheap and very delicious bao buns.
Mm-hmm. Oh, do they?
They're only like £1.50.
The E-Joy. Yeah, they're so good.
I have some interesting. I have an interesting film story. No, sorry, God, I'm so tired. Sorry, I have an interesting food story. And we'll talk about film later, but I have an interesting food story. So my girlfriend has been at mine, we did the Come Dine With Me. She did it on Sunday. I did it on Monday. Hers was great. Mine was great. But when I made my main, I made like this pasta dish, and the recipe said to put a chili in it, and I was like, I went to Lidl and just picked up a pack of chilies, not looking at what the packet was. Just thought it was this basic chili, and it wasn't. It was a Scotch bonnet, I think. It's
Oh, I've got another story after this about Scotch bonnets. You go ahead.
And chopped it up, put it in, and I thought something was off when my eyes and my throat were burning as I was cooking the food, and I was like, this is meant to be like a nice creamy Italian dish. What is going on? Then I served it, and Laura just took one bite. She's like, oh my God. And then I was like, yeah, oh my God. And not to mention, like, this was a Come Dine With Me. This was competitive. We were fighting it out. You know, I made we made starters, mains, and desserts from scratch. I made brownies for dessert. They were amazing, honestly. And I made these, sticky Korean chicken wings for starter. They were amazing. I nailed it. I nailed it all. Apart from I put this super fucking hot chili in the main, which absolutely ruined it. I was not in a good way the next day.
Would you like to hear my Scotch Bonnet story?
Oh, please.
So basically, not dissimilar to what happened to you, except I wasn't playing. I didn't make the food, actually. It was when I lived with my best friend and former housemate, in that order, Banny. He made food pretty regularly, and I was the lazy one. I didn't, and it was I think it was me and my ex girlfriend and Banny. So I mean, I've been single for about fucking 30 years, so that was a long time ago. So it was then anyway. He was like, "Oh, do you want some dinner?" And we were obviously like, "Yeah, great." I think he was making, I can't remember what he was making, some form of fucking food. I don't know, whatever. He put a Scotch bonnet in and was like, "This isn't hot enough." So put two more Scotch bonnets in. Right, it was so hot I couldn't eat. I couldn't eat like more than a couple of bites. It was like someone had a razor and they were just scraping my tongue. Like my tongue was like white hot. It was the most pain I've ever been in my life. And I was just trying to eat my dinner. Oh. And all of us left it. We were just like, this is fucking horrific. We can't continue this. So we basically, between the three of us and you and Laura, Liam, we've consumed way too many Scotch bonnets in our lives. So so that's my Scotch bonnet story. Shall we move on from Scotch bonnets to...
Stories, so feel free. Yeah.
Well, you need to make some memories, my friend. Scotch bonnet memories. Okay, we'll move on to Scotch bonnets. Let's just talk about the film that we've come here to talk about. It is North by Northwest by Alfred Hitchcock, as you will probably know. It was released in 1959, starring Cary Grant and Eve Marie. Did you say Saint, as in like Saint?
Or I would say like, Saint.
Yeah, so it's not like Saw, like French. Saw. No, Eve Marie Saint. It got 9.8 million at the box office, which I don't know how good that is, but it was like hot. Double its budget, so maybe not that good. But it is widely regarded as kind of one of the greatest films of all time, really, isn't it? And I feel like we've done a couple of them recently. We've had a few of them shouts. And it's really good. So we thought we'd tackle this one just because we've done a couple of older films, haven't we? And I think I quite enjoy doing them because I would never go there if I wasn't forced to by you two people who clearly have my best interests at heart because I always like it. So we'll talk about that a bit. What I want to do is I'll just give a little summary, a really quick one just for anyone who, I don't know, either has seen it and forgot or hasn't seen it. It revolves around Cary Grant's character, who is Roger Thornhill, and he is, long story short, involved in a mistaken identity situation where they think he is... What's the guy's name? This is bad research. Do you remember? It's a familiar name. I think his name was George Kaplan. There's a bit of a mistaken identity going on, and it leads to Cary Grant's character, Roger, kind of travelling across the country to evade... a gang of, I don't know what you'd call them. I'm going to call them thugs, but we'll probably figure out another name. And also the FBI. So it ends up with him. He goes across the country. He falls in love with Eve Marie Saint's character, also called Eve. And yeah, chaos ensues. It's pretty good. It's a good fun film. It's very much... it's not that serious, is it? It's like, whereas it's a serious film, it's quite a good crack in that. Yeah. So after that rather dodgy summary, Liam, do you want to tell me your first take on North by Northwest, please?
My first take on North by Northwest is that it's not my favourite Hitchcock film, but I did thoroughly enjoy it. I think it is for the time that it came out, probably quite progressive in that genre. I think we spoke off air, and we'll probably touch more on it later about how it's kind of been dubbed the first Bond film. I think there were a lot of Bond films after this that were inspired by it, notably the airplane scene. Did I say airplane? Aeroplane? Whatever. was inspired. Sorry, the airplane scene in North by Northwest inspired the helicopter scene in From Russia with Love. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got the older kind of suave guy. Obviously, he's not a spy in this, but eventually he becomes, in my eyes, sort of spy-like. Mm-hmm. And it gives me, you know, massive Sean Connery vibes. It made me actually, by the time it finished, I was kind of like, damn, I really wish Hitchcock had have worked with Sean Connery. I think that it would have been a match. I don't know if they have. Maybe they have, but to my knowledge, I mean, not that my knowledge is great, but I don't know if they have or not. So, yeah, basically, I thoroughly enjoyed it. Not my favourite Hitchcock film. But, yeah, it, enough fun for me to be, you know, thoroughly entertained. And there were bits I didn't like. I don't know if it's because it's... I don't know. See, I do enjoy old films. Not as much as I should, but I don't know. There was some bits that kind of maybe left me maybe a little bit detached. I don't know. But overall, no, I did really enjoy it. So yeah. First take is good.
Good first take. Connor, can you add any more to that, mate?
Yeah, I've watched quite a bit of Hitchcock, far from watching all of his stuff, and I think this is one of those films that just gets better the more and more you watch it. So I've watched this before. It's both of you. It's another first take for both of you, I think. And
yes.
What I think I like about it the most is that it doesn't feel really like a Hitchcock film. It does in how it's made and the precision and the blocking of scenes and how it's edited and scored. It all feels very Hitchcock. But, you know, I think he, just the year before this film came out, he had made and released Vertigo, which is considered like another one of the best films ever, surprise, surprise. And it's really cerebral and dark and really kind of a bit repulsing in a way, actually. I love Vertigo. I think it's an incredible film, but it's a lot more serious than this is. This feels kind of like a... It feels a bit like you kind of talked about. It feels a bit like a Bond film. It's almost an action film, almost. And I think there's a really good and interesting point that Guillermo del Toro made, that he said that Cary Grant is the best James Bond that never was James Bond, basically. Mm-hmm. And this feels like one of the better James Bond films that was made. And
yeah,
it's a parallel we'll talk about, like you said, Liam. But I don't want to get too much into it. But I just loved it. It's one of those films you could put on. Or you could catch it on TV and it could be like halfway through. And I just watched the last half because it's so good. It's so fun. Yeah. And it's really accessible as well. It's paced really well, that it doesn't feel like an old, slow, I don't know, boring film from the fucking 50s or whatever.
The last half an hour is what really got me, like, you know, really sold it to me.
Yeah.
It's such a cliche, but it... I know a lot of people say this about Hitchcock, but it is ahead of its time.
Oh, fully.
I don't want to sound like, you know, it is a cliche when people talk about Hitchcock, but the whole visual at the end, well, the end scene, one of the end scenes when they're on the on Mount Rushmore, and that's something you would see now in action films now.
Yeah.
You know, when they want to make this big kind of gravitas, show-stopping, you know, conclusion to like a spy film, and he's done it in 1959 when nothing like this had really been done before. Mm-hmm. So it makes it all the more impressive knowing that. I think that might be sometimes why it's hard to go into a film like this, having watched so many films, you know, that are very similar. You know, sometimes you do have to separate yourself from the other films you've watched and remember that this is one of the first to have done it.
Yeah, this was Hitchcock's... a precursor for it all. Yeah, fully.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, and when you take those things into consideration, then I think it is way easier to enjoy it. I think, obviously, like, Connor, you studied film. Me and Luke haven't. So I think, although... I think all three of us watch films in a different way, which is good. That's why, you know, we work doing this podcast. But I think I try to watch films like this and think critically. But there are just some things, you know, that I don't understand. And I don't know if that's maybe I was trying too hard to look for, you know, really interesting things that Hitchcock does with movement and with the way the camera moves and stuff. I don't know if I was trying to overthink it, because obviously, to you, Connor, I imagine you could pick out, you know, several things in just one scene, whereas I couldn't. But you know, that's just maybe something that I either could learn, or I don't know, or something maybe I don't even need to learn it. I suppose it's all just how you want to interpret it and how you want to read it.
I think that's really interesting, and you know, not to get too bogged down in like film heavy chat, but I'm back studying film at the minute. I'm doing my master's in it, and I'm writing a thing currently about film language and how, as people, we interpret language through signs. Like, we understand what words mean, and words together mean different things than words separately. Yeah, if that makes sense. Like, there's context in the full sentence almost. And in film, once you know the rules and know the code, it becomes so easy to follow. So, like, I think this is one of the films as well that when you look at this particular, like, era and how films were made, they were almost kind of shot like plays almost, you know what I mean? And they were shot very almost 2.5-dimensional, whereas this is, like, it's so 3D. And not only that, it kind of, it's different from Hitchcock, because normally he kind of makes one film set in one room or two locations, and this goes all over the fucking country, and I think that's really awesome. And it just shows once again that he might have made very similar films, but his versatility as a filmmaker is almost unparalleled.
Great. That's absolutely perfect, and I'm really glad that he said it goes all over the country, because I think that leads us really well into just talking about the plot. So it starts off quite abruptly, really, doesn't it? I mean, it starts off with Roger Thornhill, Cary Grant's character, kind of in the first 10 minutes just got scooting away by these mysterious men who then who think he is this guy, George Kaplan, who you go on later to find out doesn't exist. And then it's from there that kind of Roger goes across the whole country, including on a train to meet Eve Kendall, the female character. So when you say about it's quite unusual for Hitchcock traveling over the country, how did you, I don't know, there's not really a question here. I just kind of think, like, how did you find the actual plot? Did you find it enjoyable? I thought it was quite, I enjoyed the way it kind of went all over the shop, and I enjoyed the fact that, like, it wasn't just, you know, there was a lot of outdoor shots. It wasn't just in buildings or in, like, on the train. I just found it really, like, when you were saying it's like Bond, I just thought it was a proper jaunt, just a really good jaunt across the country. And, like, it wasn't kind of what you'd it wasn't what I would have expected from a Hitchcock film, having not seen that many, but having known about him, obviously, being this great director. I almost thought it was, in a good way, perfectly simple and enjoyable.
Yeah.
And I just kind of want to know almost like what you, and there's no real question there, just like what you guys felt about the plot. I mean, maybe start with Liam, because obviously it's his first take. Like, what did you make of it all? Like, especially the different beats, how did you feel about the plot?
Yeah, I really enjoyed the plot. I think, obviously, taking the direction aside, the actual story is really quite, not, I wouldn't say complex, but when you include double crossings and, you know, almost triple crossings and spies, undercover spies, and it's that whole espionage-esque type of spy movie in parts that kind of make you have to really think about, you know, you are constantly watching the characters, because you know straight, as it's introduced, you know, within the first 10 minutes that Cary Grant has been mistaken for someone else, then I feel like every character is, you have to be suspect.
You can't trust anyone, basically. No,
you can't trust anyone at all. And yeah, I just really, really enjoyed that kind of dynamic. I've got it on in the background right now, and it's the scene in the train with Roger and Eve. And, you know, I actually thought in that moment when they first start, you know, kissing each other and whatever, I just thought she was just horny for a bad boy.
Aren't we all a Bombay bad boy? This is sponsored by Pot Noodle.
Give me some noodles. Well,
because, she keeps saying, you know, because obviously she knows that he's a wanted man and that she keeps flirting with him. The next minute, you know, after they kiss, she passes a note over to the bad guys that are also on the train. So then, all right, okay, then she's dodgy then. She's dodgy. And then half an hour later, oh no, she's not really dodgy. She's actually working for you know, our intelligence. Well, I don't know. I don't even know what spy is it. is it MI5 or is it?
I think
CIA
it's the FBI.
I thought it was the FBI.
It's the FBI. Yeah.
Okay, it's the FBI. Okay, it just confuses me because there's like British people in this, it's Americans, yeah. So it's yeah. You don't know who. Okay, so it doesn't specify. That's fine. But you know, then half an hour later, she's good, and then again, she's bad, and then she shoots him, and you what?
It's very
on?
Hitchcock, isn't it? The whole like, oh, never trust an attractive lady. Women are bad. That's it. Well, yeah. It's not really Hitchcock's whole bag, but you know what I mean. He's a relatively sketchy fellow. I think she's one of the most interesting characters in this. And I know we're going to come back to the Bond thing in a minute, but she gives me real. Was it Vesper Lynn? Is that the character in Casino Royale? Real Eva Green vibes in that. Oh, like, you never know if you can trust her.
Yeah,
you're kind of rooting for her, but you kind of know something's not right there.
Yeah, because it's only really her and the woman that plays Cary Grant's mum, who is she's 7 years older than him and plays his mum. That's so weird.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, they're the only two really female characters in this. Mm. And one of them doesn't really get much screen time. So you're totally reliant on Eva as, you know, the sole kind of female protagonist or antagonist. You're not really sure. And so I think she holds her own so well. Obviously down to her, and she's had quite a long career. I think she's still alive. She was in something I watched recently. She was in a film not so long ago and I can't remember what it is. I'm not going to try and think now because it'll just hurt my brain. But yeah, she's brilliant in this. See, for me personally, I mentioned earlier about how, I don't know if it was off air actually, about how obviously Hitchcock and films back then, they had a tendency to cast older men to play a character that is supposed to be quite younger. Like, I think Cary Grant was maybe like 55 when he was playing this role. And Eva, her name is the actress' name is Eva May Saint, Eva Marie Saint.
Yeah,
Eva Marie Saint. I think she was a whole 20 years younger than him, but was also actually playing a 26-year-old. So she was 35 playing a 26-year-old.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of I struggle to kind of watch a film and kind of connect with like the male character when they're so old. That's why I don't really like Roger Moore's Bond at all, because he's by the time he was doing his last couple of films, he looked so old and he was getting with these really young girls, and it's quite uncomfortable.
Uh-huh.
That's just like, obviously it was something that was normal back then in the film. In for some reason, I don't really know why actually, but it's just something that I don't like.
Yeah,
that's fair enough. I think, sorry, Colin, just to interrupt, but it's really interesting that you say it exactly, because it is actually quite a complex, within the small amount of contained characters, there's a lot of back and forth between a few different things. And I still even now see it as actually quite a simple movie, but it actually probably isn't really. I just interrupted you halfway through saying about to say something then, Connor. So do you want to just finish your point? You didn't even start it. Start your point, and then maybe just give us a little sample of how you feel. How you felt
just
about
hurry
the
up
plot.
There, Connor? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Cool. No, I was just going to say I think the film, obviously it relies a lot on Hitchcock and how incredible he is, and the Oscar nominated scripts, and I actually think the script's really good as well. And watch how Hitchcock, I don't know, kind of structures the whole narrative in a really simple way is really impressive. But for me, I think that my main thing is I just love the chemistry between these two. Yeah. I think Cary Grant is just one of the coolest dudes. And I know he's not lechy, you know what I mean? But like the whole kind of age difference.
He's very orange, isn't he? He's very orange.
He's got a bit of that Trump spray tan on.
I think he looks good. I don't think he looks orange, but
well, maybe it's just maybe it was just the settings on my TV as well then. But
maybe it's just he looks like he loves a holiday in Spain.
Oh yeah, he's got Roger Thornhill has a couple of holiday homes somewhere in town.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, for me, I think that the real driving force of this film is just it's just the characters and the relationship between them, and that kind of not knowing if you can trust them and not really knowing how and why George has gotten involved in this, or Roger, sorry, I keep it, Roger's gotten involved in this is really interesting. I think that's kind of, it's the constant, I don't know, I think people call Hitchcock the master of tension or whatever, or the master of suspense, but this kind of is just intrigue, and you kind of want to find out more, and it keeps pulling you in, and he's just so good, man. He's such a good filmmaker.
Here's an interesting question. Did you ever, for once in the film, think that Roger Thornhill was actually a spy?
Good question. I don't think.
I don't think I did either. I can't remember when the first time I watched this. Maybe it might only been a couple of years ago, but I think I just trusted him completely.
There was one moment. I think it was the leading up to the auction scene, which is hilarious, by the way. I don't know. He almost seemed to. It's after he kind of escapes the aeroplane, which tries to shoot him in a field. Mm-hmm. I don't know. He seems to, the way he gets away from the you know, he kind of escapes that and almost completely unscathed. And he seems to just keep getting lucky. The way he's like puts on a pair of glasses and suddenly he's invisible. Yeah, I kind of like that. That's so spy movie.
Yeah,
I don't know. I think at one point I was thinking he's too good at this. Surely he is a spy. Uh-huh. But obviously in the end he isn't. But I think that's just good writing to make
it is, yeah,
to make that something like that even cross your mind, because he's so. The character is so adamant throughout the whole film. I mean, he tells us so many times that it's a mistake. It's mistaken identity. Please believe me. I've literally had booze poured down my throat. It was a setup. But still, I was sat there about an hour in thinking, I think you actually might be a spy and you might be a bit dodged. But no, he actually wasn't. And testament to the writer, Ernest Lehman.
Yeah, I'd say Lehman.
Lehman. He also wrote West Side Story as well. And I was looking at something before we came on air about the set design, and it was so impressive. I can't think of the guy who did it, but I know he worked with Hitchcock a few times, and kind of the lengths he went to. Obviously, there are some aspects of the airplane scene that are shot, you know, real time with a real airplane, but obviously others where he's where Cary Grant's kind of diving on the ground, ducking. They created this massive airplane, and then with the Mount Rushmore as well, they did shoot on Mount Rushmore at times, but they also had to create, you know, actual molds of the big heads in their studio. There's another scene as well where near the end where they're running through a forest. You know, that's they couldn't get a permit to go to this forest that Hitchcock wanted to shoot in. So instead, they planted like 300 trees in the studio, and and used that instead, which is just so, you know, the intricacy of that.
Yeah, that is fast.
I was this is another interesting thing with the set design and kind of the pull that Cary Grant had over Hitchcock. He basically, I think it might have been actually. The scene just before Mount Rushmore where Cary Grant's character, Roger Thornhill, is going to save, you know, in quotations, save Eve from the bad guys in their home before they're about to fly off and actually kill her. And he mentioned to Hitchcock that he didn't like the look of the set. He said it looked almost sloppy. So then Hitchcock didn't even go and look. He just believed him straight away and got the set, the guys working on the set to just completely knock it down and rebuild it. And that's literally the pull that Cary Grant had. And that's how much trust Hitchcock had in him. That's probably why he worked on so many films of his. I think like dynamics like that are so interesting. I think that's why you know, these characters and these actors work so well with certain directors and certain filmmakers. Sorry, yeah, I just thought I'd go on a bit of a...
No, that's, I like that. That was
I'm
a really
fully here for it.
That's a really interesting monologue, and there's three things that I just didn't have a clue about, so that was really, that was really sick. So let's move slightly on to... So what point did you start to... So at the beginning of the film, you don't actually... You know, there's this character, George Kaplan, and you don't know kind of who he is, what he's supposed to have done. You just, all you know is that a bit of a mistaken identity, and Roger Thornhill is supposed to be him. But at what point did you start to understand what might be happening, and that there would be either maybe some spy situation going on or some double crossing? Because I just, until the scene about 25 minutes in, maybe half an hour in, where they go to the FBI meeting room and they like spell it out to you, I was just like, I was thoroughly enjoying whatever was fucking going on, but I had not a clue what was going on. where was the point where you thought, like, you kind of, I don't know, suppose you realised what was going on? Connor, I'll go to you.
I think for me, like I said, I've watched it a couple times, but I think, like I said, it also gets better the more you watch it, because you know who to trust and who not to trust, and that way, when you watch them, the characters do what they're doing. It's like you can almost see the plans being made for the future. You get me? But I remember the first time I watched this, definitely. I remember seeing, I think the actual character's name is Eve, on the train, and their interaction, and thinking, like, I've watched enough Hitchcock here to know that I'm not meant to fully trust this lady. And I just, you kind of know that she has a larger role to play in just being kind of like a sidekick character or someone who's just along for the ride. I always kind of expected there to be a couple, you know, maybe one double cross and maybe several, like there is in the film. And yeah, I think I always knew that Roger being led into the field where the plane chase happens. I already kind of knew that scene through osmosis, and like picking up through, you know, it being in it referenced all the time.
I knew the airplane scene from Family Guy.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's all right. So Liam, I suppose when did you start to slowly pull together the pieces to understand what was kind of going on? Because I think, I suppose when you say about him being whether he was actually a spy, I don't think I ever thought he was, but maybe I didn't ever rule it out, because I was very much like, until towards the end of the film where Cary Grant meets Eve in the forest, and then you fully know that she's on board with him. You kind of like, anything could happen here. Where did you get to?
I didn't trust or believe anyone, genuinely. even when the head of the FBI, I forget the character's name, tells Roger that Eve is in fact with him, and she is she's one of the good guys. And she's undercover trying to get, you know, I guess the baddies are meant to be Russian spies, because they mentioned the Cold War. She's trying to get intel on them, and that's that whole situation. She isn't actually in love with this guy, from the, you know, the bad guys. But genuinely, even when he was explaining to Ra, I still didn't believe. I still thought maybe he's bad too. Maybe they're all bad. I don't know. Until it was literally spelled out for me right at the end, I didn't want to try and say, oh yeah, okay, definitely this person's good, this person's good, this person's bad, this person's bad. I kind of left it open for interpretation right until the end in my own mind. I don't know why. I usually do like to guess, but this time, for some reason, I was just going to go with it and not trust anyone.
Yeah,
just went wrong with their eyes. I think, for the first time in a while, I don't think I tried to figure it out. Maybe that's why for a little while I fucking completely didn't. But I just was kind of like, I'm not even going to bother it. Because I think what's quite helpful is it starts off not confusing, but it starts off in a way that you're like, well, I'm obviously not meant to necessarily know what's happening here completely. So I probably felt more comfortable just sitting back and watching, really. All right, so what... here's a question. I was going to do this a little bit later on, but I think it'd be it's a good time to ask it now. What were some of your favourite scenes or moments in the movie, Connor?
It has to be for me. Like I know the crop dusting playing scene is iconic and is probably one of the most iconic images and scenes in American film history.
Yeah,
but for me, it's the auction scene. Because I think, like I said, Hitchcock is an incredibly versatile filmmaker. And even though most of his films, you can maybe say that there's a large similarity in a lot of his films, at least especially up to 1959 when he made this. It feels like you're seeing him actually have fun. And you hear all these stories about how, you know, strict he was and how much of a, for want of a better phrase, bit of a bad dickhead he was behind scenes. And I think this scene and seeing how Cary Grant plays it, it just always makes me smile. It's almost a departure from the normal kind of cerebral, grueling kind of Hitchcock film and tropes that we imagine from him. I think it kind of sums up the film perfectly. Like like I said, you kind of go into it, there is a little bit of confusion. There's a lot of humor. It's fun. And it really relies on the character, the characters mainly Cary Grant. In this scene.
Yeah, fair. That's a good answer. Liam, how about you, mate?
There's one moment that actually made me like properly lol. Sorry to use that term. when Roger Thornhill is escaping from a room that he's been put into by the FBI, he then comes back through a room and there's a woman in bed, like a different woman. And she says, I can't think exactly what it is she says. She says something along the lines of, stop what you're doing. And then she goes, no, stop. Like, as in immediately, within like 5 seconds, she thinks she's going to get murdered to then being completely horny and wanting to come into bed with her.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't know if that was literally meant to be... oh yeah, she definitely wants to have sex with him, or she is like another spy that is trying to keep tabs on him. So she's like trying to seduce him so he doesn't escape. Like, and then he kind of like looks at her and goes, "Oh, for God's sake!"
Just yeah, I know.
It's this like the comedy in that moment. I think it is brilliant. So yeah, that's probably my favorite moment.
Great. I think my favorite is I really like it, and not because it's like necessarily like a great scene. Like obviously, I think if we were to choose great or iconic scenes, it'd be like either Rushmore or the plane scene. But I just really like, just in terms of like a charm, getting a charm from it, I really like the driving scene at the beginning when he's been fed this half a pint of bourbon by the bad guys in the film, who we haven't really spoke about, but the bad guys in the film, and then he is pushed into a car and essentially bailed on, and he's got to drive himself along this mountainous stretch of roads, and I think just that the style of this film being, you know, 50, 60 years old, and the acting in it, it's kind of overacting but also not overacting, and I don't know, I just think it's really funny but probably not in a way that's maybe intended. But I just like that. And also, and I say this because it just came on the screen about 20 minutes ago because I've got it on the background, the shaving scene when he's in the railway. So he's in the railway and then he goes into like the shower area in the station, and he's got shaving foam all over his face, and then the people come in after him and can't tell it's him because he's got shaving foam all over his face, and he's got like a little tiny razor, and like the guy next to him notices he's got this big razor, and they just kind of have a little like man-o-man little look at each other. And I just think that's pretty funny as well. But there's loads, isn't there? There's loads of bits where you can say, oh, I don't like, you know, the scene's not necessarily amazing, but like there's just lines or bits of dialogue or little things that happen throughout the whole film. Just before we move on to like, we want to talk about the similarities of, you know, between this and like Bond and that, I think we should touch on the bad guys, because we haven't at all really. So the guys who are essentially trying to chase Roger Thornhill across the country because they think he is this person that he isn't. What do you make of the bad guys? I think they're really traditionally like not very greatly fleshed out bad guys, which is absolutely fine. I think the main guy, who is Philip Van Damme, sounds so much like Matthew Berry. It is unbelievable. I've never heard anyone sound more like anyone else in my life. But I just want to generally just have a little chat about, like, they're not really that well fleshed out, are they? But I think they make, I don't know, they're kind of humorous and just kind of like archetypical, maybe 50s bad guys. What did you make of the performances and them in general?
I think what's interesting about Philip Van Damme, I actually think they do try and give him a little bit of character.
Yeah.
You know, it's quite apparent that he is quite easily manipulated by women. He tries to, even when, you know, there is clear evidence staring him in the face that she is, you know, a bad egg to him, he still doesn't see it and he still wants to... He still wants to take her with him. It's the other fella that is, you know, kind of notices it straight away. Well, he finds the gun that fires blanks, doesn't he? But, you know, even then, before he found it, he seemed a little bit, you know, suspecting of her. And I think, yeah, that might be maybe one of the only things they really give you to kind of try and figure out what type of person he is. Obviously, he's to the Americans, he's a baddie, but I think he is maybe a bit lonely and a bit, what, you know, he wants love. Because he doesn't seem, actually, I suppose at one point he does have his hands like around the back of her neck and it is a bit, you know, controlling and a bit kind of almost abusive and manipulative, manipulating his power. But I think, you know, he probably thinks that she's just some dumb blonde that he can, you know, do whatever he likes with.
Trophy wife.
But yeah, trophy wife. But he still almost like loves her in a way. And he still almost like has an attachment to her, so much so that he kind of does overlook some of the, obviously, some of the double crossings that are quite apparent at some points in the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Anything to add there, Connor?
Honestly, not really. I was basically just going to say how much, like, they just seem like a kind of, I don't know, like a vehicle for the story to progress. And
yeah, they are, aren't they?
For Roger and Eve to kind of, like, escape from and have altercations with. And I think another credit to the script and Hitchcock and the filmmaking in this is there's a kind of, like, an ideal in screenwriting where from A to B, say if A is your character starting point and B is the end, maybe we'll say A to Z, I'll flesh it out a bit more. The kind of letters in between should be hurdles where your character is close to getting what he wants and how you think the film's going to play out, and then another hurdle gets in the way. And I think this film is a real example of how to do that well without it being kind of, I don't know, without it being a bit, without getting bogged down in the kind of minutiae of filmmaking tropes. Like, it's always really enjoyable. The bad guys, despite the fact that they're not really fleshed out that often, they're always kind of fun when they're on screen. At least I think they're kind of fun.
Yeah, they are. I think they are fun. I think they're not fleshed out particularly, and I agree with you that they are just they are almost like base level antagonists, like just to allow the film to have purpose. But I also just like I don't think that's a weakness, and I imagine that is probably done purposely. And I just think in terms of the tone of this film, they're probably like the perfect bad guy, like a little bit caricature-y of like general, like we're going to say in a minute, James Bond bad guy, but not boring enough to like critique.
And just before we jump on, well, another thing I love about this film is that like the stakes aren't uber high, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not like save the world like James Bond can be quite a lot often. It's more just kind of, it's all relative to the characters. And even though there's maybe a bigger picture in play, you only really care about the characters. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely. I think it does make sense. And I like that as well. I think that's one thing that properly, that's one thing that attracts me to it. And again, like you said before, if I see it on the telly, I think very much like, this is a good segue. Very much like when you see the James Bonds on telly, you don't really have to know where it's up to. Like, you know, the stakes are so low in a really handy way that you can kind of just pick it up, can't you? But let's use that moment. So we've probably got about 10 minutes to go. So let's use that moment to just have a chat about the similarities to Bond, because this is something that we were just having a chat about off air, and Liam raised, and I'd thought it yesterday when I was watching it, but didn't necessarily think much more about. I just kind of thought this is very Bondy. So did you, I suppose, I'd never heard about that before. So I suppose, did you guys hear of it and then notice it very much in the movie? And do you think maybe this was not what Bond films were going for necessarily? Because I actually think if this was a Bond film, it'd probably be one of the best Bond films. But what do you make of the similarities between kind of like that, especially some of the earlier Bonds and this movie?
I think it just kind of shows that there is kind of a market for this kind of, I don't want to say camp, but it is a bit kind of over the top, a little bit cringy, a little bit elbow in the ribs. Oh, did you see what I just did there? There's a couple of like innuendos, and even the fucking last shot is a train going into a fucking tunnel.
Yeah.
You know what they're trying to say there, do you know what I mean? And I like that though, because it is a little bit tongue-in-cheek and it's fun. It's a bit over the top, and I don't know. I think it helps a lot when you see a filmmaker as revered as Hitchcock was, and now is. But at the time, he was obviously championed as like a hero for cinema. And he, if he's making films like this, and then the next year can go on and make a film like Psycho, and before that, he made Vertigo. Like, those three films kind of sum up him as a filmmaker, and each one offers something different. And the fact that he could do this and almost essentially popularize it as a genre, hats off, you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. Liam, do you want to give us some of your thoughts on the Bond comparison? Because it was you who mentioned it before, that kind of jogged my memory. So just give us a little few lines on what you thought.
Yeah, I think like the final set piece with on Mount Rushmore feels very Bond-like. I feel like Roger Thornhill feels very Bond, very suave, sophisticated, you know, good looking, older. That's, you know, kind of like he's definitely not Roger Moore-esque, but obviously in terms of the kind of the age, I suppose Sean Connery didn't look exactly young when he was Bond. I can't actually remember how old he was when he first started playing Bond. But I guess it's just that those sort of similarities, the whole, obviously the spy element. I think the only thing that is massively different, well, obviously for the main difference, is that Roger Thornhill isn't actually a spy. He's just been caught up in this mess. But I think the baddies aren't very Bond-like at all, really. Yeah. They're a bit, you know, I don't think Hitchcock was going for that. It's more of a, you know, they're Russian spies, you know, they're just Russian spies. It's not like they are, you know, Thanos or someone like
exactly
that.
That's what I mean. The stakes aren't high enough for it to be like...
They just serve a purpose, don't they?
One man, one ordinary man, Roger Thornhill, needs to stop the Nazis or stop the, I don't know, the bad dudes from doing this. And you're like, no, it's just it's just one guy and his kind of... As luck would have it, he's mistaken for someone who is apparently a spy or whatever. And
What I do think is really funny is that I just got in the background now, and I'm just the Bond comparison. Actually, when you watch it, especially with like the sound off, and you're just kind of like looking at it, it's really like that. The beats are all there. Really, you've got like this guy meets this girl, and then he goes to another place and happens to come across her again. And then they're in a hotel, and then there's like the love scene, and then. You know what I mean? And like, and Bond tends to go all over the world different places. And so it feels almost like I don't know when the first Bond was out, and I imagine it was probably 60, maybe between 62 and 69, maybe. I don't know. But it just feels like all the beats are there, especially when I'm like, well, I'm just watching it on mute, and it just feels very like a caricature of James Bond a bit, but
You are right. It was 1962, I think, is when Dr. No came out, which I think the first Bond film, I think.
Yeah, so there was Casino Royale, wasn't there? That was like a bit of a comedy.
Oh, yeah.
It was like an unofficial. I think it was written by, maybe it was written by Fleming, but I don't know. But it was that is technically the first film with James Bond in it. But yeah. I think what the iteration that we would call like 007 James Bond was, yeah, Dr. No.
As well as that, just, I think it was you, Liam, that mentioned that about Sean Connery and Alfred Hitchcock, and they worked together on a film called Marnie. I don't know if you've heard of it or watched it.
I haven't.
And it's kind of about, once again, there's this female character called Marnie who has a bit of a double life. She maybe made some decisions that she's going to regret soon, and she falls in with this guy who's played by Sean Connery, and he is a bad boy. Everyone loves a bad boy. So yeah, they have worked together, but I think that's the only time I can remember it anyway. That's all cool. I've got for you.
Yeah, that's all we need. That's all we need. Let's go for any other business really now. So we've probably in about 5 minutes been doing this an hour. So is there anything else that like we haven't touched on that you were desperate to kind of have a chat about, Liam?
Where does this rank?
Oh, here we go.
Your favourite Alfred Hitchcock films. I'll go first. I've only seen this, Psycho, and Rear Window. I don't have many to choose from. Mm-hmm. Rear Window is my favourite.
Mm-hmm.
Then Psycho, then this. But, you know, I'm picking out three films I've seen, so it's not like it's the worst one.
And they're all awesome films, though, as well. Like, yeah.
They're all amazing.
I think for me, I've only seen Psycho, I think. I've only seen Psycho, but I honestly think I think it's better than Psycho, and I also think that I would maybe struggle to find something that I enjoyed as much as this, purely because I think it's actually quite accessible. Like we were saying about the bad guys aren't really, aren't kind of high stakes. The whole film isn't high stakes. So it's actually, you know, when you think of Hitchcock, I do kind of think either high stakes or, I don't know, maybe just more intensity maybe.
Yeah.
And I actually think that this isn't that. And I think this is almost like ideal Hitchcock for me. I think I struggle to find. I could watch all of his back catalogue, and I'm going to try and watch. I'd like to watch Vertigo. And I'm going to try and watch a couple more. But
let us do Vertigo on the podcast, please.
We can do Vertigo on the podcast.
I know we've already spoke about what we're going to do for Halloween, but our Halloween pod. But I suppose The Birds is classed as a horror, right?
Yeah.
And
It's intense. It's a very intense watch, I think. Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like I've seen so many pictures of the fake birds. I don't know if I'd be able to.
Fair point.
So do you want to? What's your? Where does it rank for you, Connor? Because maybe you've probably seen a little bit more than.
It's definitely in my top five. I think I've maybe watched about seven or eight, potentially, Hitchcock films. Maybe six or seven. It's in my top five, definitely. I don't think it's, for me, it's not as good as Vertigo. I think Vertigo, it could be considered like one of the, it's a perfect film. This is like, it is genuinely perfect. It's probably up, it's beside Rear Window. I think it's probably top two, three. Nice. Because Vertigo for me, I'm going to give it to Rear Window just because I prefer James Stewart over Cary Grant, and that they were kind of his two leading men. I think it would go, Vertigo, Rear Window, and then North by Northwest.
Wow, that's pretty good. Because for someone who's seen quite a few Hitchcock movies, that's quite high praise, really.
It's just fun. That's what I mean. It comes, I think the main selling point for me is the, you know, if it was on TV, I wouldn't turn it off. I'd watch the end of it.
I think that as well, you know, and I actually think it's quality. Like, we say it's not high stakes, and we say, like, it's easy watching, but it is, like, it's quality as well. Like, that doesn't take anything away from the fact that it is just a really good film.
Mm-hmm.
All right, cool. So let's go popcorns. I think that'll be a good idea. I'll give my popcorns at a really, really, like, well, I think it's solid 77.
Cool. I think that's fair. I think I would give it 85.
Oh, wow. Wowee. Liam?
I would go 75.
Okay.
Yeah. I feel like that's fair.
Definitely. Yeah,
75. Obviously, if I watch it again, it might climb. I know that there are a lot of people that do, you know, count this as his best film. I've seen a lot of, I think... Empire magazine did a ranking of Hitchcock, and I'm sure North by Northwest was number one. I'm sure
did
it
they
was.
Do sorry did they do a podcast, or was that just
they did a podcast as well as a ranking in their magazine, and I'm sure it was North by Northwest.
Wow.
So,
I mean, you're not missing if you swap this for, or you swap Vertigo for this, or you swap Psycho for that. Either way, you're winning.
I think it's because, as you said, Luke, this film is so accessible. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably why it does maybe show up as on the top spot, you know, in a lot of Hitchcock rankings. It's just, I think I do prefer, you know, I've only seen three of his films, but, you know, Psycho and Rear Window are far more suspenseful, mm-hmm. and, you know, a lot darker. And I kind of like that. You know, that to me is, that is, before I started watching Hitchcock films, that is what I expected of his films. So I feel like, I don't know, it's just maybe something in that for me is why I prefer them sort of films from him.
I think that's when he's at his best as well. Like, this shows off all of his talents as a filmmaker, but when he's really in his element with films, like you just mentioned, he is almost unstoppable. Like, he really is.
Yeah. Cool. Great. Awesome. But I think that was really, this is in terms of films that we've done, one of the ones that I've just kind of thoroughly enjoyed the most in a long time.
Awesome.
So I'm really glad that we did it. And this is to anyone who's listening, we like actively encourage you to give us a shout either about this film or about films that you want us to watch in the future and do a podcast about. We're pretty open books, and we generally kind of make plans a few weeks in advance, but they're never really solid plans, so we can always kind of just do whatever we want. So please do engage with us. You can get in contact with us on our socials at First Take Pod. We are on Twitter and Instagram, and First Take Film Club on Facebook. We also have our own personal Twitters, which I just don't even know all of ours, so we'll just say you'll be able to see us hanging around our own pod Twitter. But thank you very much for listening. We've got next week's, haven't we? So next week, if you want to turn up, we are doing the Rocky Horror Picture Show, which
I can't wait for this. You know, normally it would be me being like, oh, we're watching this crap, are we? But I love this film, and I don't know why, but I just do.
I think I am I'm super curious, maybe like the most curious that I've been for a film.
Is it both of your first takes?
Okay.
I thought maybe you'd saw it before, Luke. Oh, that's interesting.
No, I'm really keen to. And I also think that we need to get you a first take on the podcast pretty soon. But we can, whatever. You know, we can come to that bridge when we get to it. But
we can give you a first take the week out. We're going to do a couple of weeks of Halloween films, right? So I guess we'll do Rocky Horror next week, and the week after we'll let Connor pick his spooky season film.
I vote
Hubie Halloween, the Adam Sandler Netflix film.
Have you watched that, Liam?
I've watched it, yeah.
I 100% vote for that.
Okay, it's... what did you think, Liam? I know you.
Really good fun.
I really enjoyed it.
Please don't make me do it.
No, I don't think we should.
It's not one for the podcast. But
the opening 20 minutes, right, are solid and genuinely some of the best Sandler in years. And then it goes all right, and then there are bits that are awful. But like overall, it's good.
It's like mid-90s Sandler, where he's playing this kind of like unusual, socially awkward character, and gets made fun of, and then at the end there's payoff, and it's just, you know what, the longer my life goes on, the more my love for Sandler continues. So we should leave it there before we lose all our fucking listeners for the next few weeks. So I just want to say thank you very much for listening. Please do engage with us at First Take Pod, and keep yourself safe, and see you next time.